Welcome to the podcast. Welcome to the podcast, Jaxie. Yeah, thanks for being here.
Sure, thank you. Sorry, getting my podcast rhythm down.
No, it's all good. It's all good. Before we get started, I just wanted to acknowledge I'm producing this podcast on the stolen lands of the Comox, Clayhoos, Homoko, and Kala'aman First Nations. Grateful to be here. So Jaxie, tell me a little bit about yourself.
Sure. So I am a clinical psychologist and a board certified behavior analyst. I currently work at Sandoval Regional Medical Center during the week, so Monday through Friday. I'm in their primary care, which means I just see everybody that walks in the door that needs some behavioral health assistance, as well as employees and just everybody around. It's a fairly rural area, so we see everyone throughout the state that we can. People that don't have access to care in their communities, things like that. And then I also work on weekends doing autism assessments in my private practice. And that also is throughout the state, but that's all telehealth. So nobody comes to me. I don't really come to them. We use the internet and the miracle that it is for the most part.
Sorry, what state is that again?
That's in New Mexico.
You're in New Mexico, right? Okay, gotcha. Cool. Right on. And so maybe just tell me a little bit about kind of, who you are, where you come from, and kind of your story a bit, and then and kind of eventually kind of how you got into ABA and psychology.
Sure. Well, I wanted to say this as well, that I really appreciate your acknowledgement at the beginning of all your podcasts. Most podcasts, I kind of skip through their intros, but I always listen to yours.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, sure. Well, and I do appreciate that. As a Native American, I think it's meaningful that all the work that you do to kind of like raise other voices up. And I really appreciate it. So that kind of connects with my history. So while I was born here in New Mexico, my tribe is Chickasaw. There are Chickasaws here as well, but much less than within our current tribal lands, which are in the southeast region of Oklahoma. So we have capital there and government and kind of set up, but it's not a reservation, which is very different than most of the tribes that grew up around here in New Mexico. It's also not a pueblo, which is also very common out here in the southwest. But we have sort of a separate history that's more similar to tribes in the southeast region of the United States. So I guess kind of hundreds of years of history related to me coming closer to that, is my family is from Oklahoma, but they moved here, a few years before I was born, and most of them are still there. They've moved back and they live in that region. And then I went to school here, high school graduate, and then went to college at the University of Kentucky and then graduate school at Rutgers. And then made my way back here a few years ago for all of those things. So I guess that's part of it. So I chose Rutgers, and this is probably more relevant to our conversation today. Not only because I was lucky enough to get in there, but also because they have a dual, at the time they had a dual doctorate in psychology and applied behavior analysis track. It is the only program I know of that has ever done that. And so I was accepted onto that track and was able to complete it. So.
Right on. Okay. Lots to unpack. Maybe we'll talk a little bit about, the sort of school career choices. And then I want to learn more about the Chickasaw Nation. So, Why did you want ABA? Why did you kind of want to find ABA in clinical psychology in the first place? So what was sort of your early dream or whatever? Like, what made you go? Are you looking for a way to recognize World Autism Month in a meaningful, actionable way? Foundations for Divergent Minds is a nonprofit organization rooted in the belief that all neurodivergent people should be able to thrive in the communities they live, work, and play. We are offering courses to professionals to provide a space to explore neurodiversity through a different lens while staying true to your field. Every course fee directly supports our programs tackling healthcare gaps for autistics of color, designing local community programs, and promoting safety for autistic people. We recognize that the fear of discomfort can be a big deterrent for many people, but that also discomfort is the place where growth comes from. So we created several courses aimed at offering this space to different fields of practice. One for teachers, educators, speech-language pathologists, occupational therapists, and counselors, and the other for behavior analysts. If you're unsure what steps to take to build a neurodiversity-aligned practice, these courses are a great resource and co-instructed by professionals in your field of practice. For the behavior analyst course, go to FDM, that's F as in Frank, D as in Donald, M as in Mary, .training/response. Everyone else can go to FDM.training/implement. And now, for a limited time, you can use the discount code BEHAVIORSPEAKS, all caps, to receive a 10% discount. Hope to see you there. In that direction.
I think the earliest I remember thinking about a career in a more serious sense, I was 11. So before that, I think I wanted to be a wedding planner or an astronomer or an accountant. Yeah. Like I had like all these very weird things, not knowing what careers were. Yeah. But around age 11, I think I started thinking about it more seriously, and I knew I wanted to do something with people. I'm like very socially motivated. I'm like much happier interacting with people. I learn better when I'm interacting with people, as opposed to like a lot of other things that other people are great at. So I knew I wanted to do that probably around that age. But I went to a high school that was very like math and science and politically focused. So they didn't actually offer any courses related to that the entire time I was there. So they did offer history, and so I liked that. But then I developed my own course, which was a nice option, in psychology. And so in that course, the teacher taught me about autism, and that was it. I was like, oh, how do you do this? How do you work with people with autism? Wow. What do I need to do with that? And so he said, well, you could be a psychologist or a behavior analyst. And then I was like, well, I guess I could try to do both. And so there it was. Fortunately, it worked out.
Yeah. And so did you kind of do the sort of traditional sort of, you know, journey, like RBT all the way up kind of thing, or were you more kind of into the academic side of things and then practice kind of after, like kind of how'd that go?
So my training was a bit of a mix, and I think it's because of the way the track was set up, I imagine. So you, at least in New Jersey, when I was doing it, you had to do RBT work in order to get your BCBA, because you had to demonstrate like those thousands of hours of clinical contact and show that you could do it. However, there was also a lot of research requirements as well. So doing presentations, taking a lot of the data and interpreting it on that level, I think, I don't know if it's because they were thinking about it more academically because I was in that sort of setting at the time. But yeah, I think it was both. I did RBT in the center and at and home base as well. And then also, yeah, all the research presentations, interpretations with it at the same time.
Right on. And so the work you're doing now, so you do the assessments sort of privately, which is great. And the work you're doing in kind of this in primary care at this medical center, is that, you know, like with anyone, or is that with autistic folks, or what kind of work are you doing there?
So primary care, it really is anyone. You know, it's amazing the people that make it to their appointments. You know, I've had a few thoughts about like, how did you get here? Like, we're in the middle of nowhere. Like, how did you arrive, get it together enough to arrive here? So like substance use, psychosis, But also I see quite a few people on the spectrum across the age range here, as well as, you know, typical depression, anxiety, trauma, adjustment disorder, not taking their medication, I mean, just anything that's a behavior I can help with. So I see that there.
Yeah, right on. Cool. Okay, so maybe and then do you do the autism evaluations by telehealth? I mean, is that with kind of anyone, or are you sort of helping like certain groups? Or how do folks get to you for that? Is it all kind of private pay? Like, how's that all work?
So I focus on 5 and up. Yeah, so age 5 years and older. As far as I know, currently I'm the only provider in the state taking adults. So I do see a lot more adults for that reason. And then, but at the same time, I see a lot of younger children. So I guess, again, I'm open to the whole range, but I actually kind of see them at the extreme ends, like kids that just have turned 5. Sometimes they'll kind of push it for 4 if they're really concerned and they really need services right away, all the way into like their 60s, 70s, usually that.
And so why not before 5, mostly?
So a couple of reasons. I think I could do 3 and 4 in person. So if I had a space to do that, which I'm kind of working on now, I may look more into that. But there really isn't, at least from my perspective, a great way to assess a child remotely that is the age 3 to 5. I haven't found anything that does that versus like 5. There's a pretty good assessment tool that does have some good research. It's relatively new, but some good research to back it up, for the age range closer to like 5 to 7. But I actually like for a lot of reasons. But anyway, and then beyond that, usually they can sit in front of a computer. I can like administer other testing and things I can do. But younger than that, like that 3 to 5 range, there really isn't currently, in my opinion, or to my knowledge, there might be something out there. And then below 3, I think you really need specialized training. I've had some exposure to it, and I think it's really important, but you're just not doing that much before that age. Is to know the difference of like, oh, this is a delay versus not, and also this is not Angel syndrome or fetal alcohol syndrome or all these other disorders that could have these exact same presentations before age 3. Takes a lot of specialized training that I do not have. So I
There's lots of things to rule out that you probably can't just do through observation too. There's probably some like genetic testing and different things like that for some of these things.
Yes. Yeah. Especially some of the ones that unfortunately have a lot of stigma, which sometimes involves autism as well. But, you know, parents are not always straightforward about trauma that their child has experienced, especially with a stranger or somebody outside of their community as well. And so that can have a huge impact on how your child's developing, especially in attaching and interacting with other people. And then, yes, like the genetic tests, again, if there's substance use involved, sometimes parents are straightforward about that, but a lot of times they aren't. And that has a similar presentation, especially before age 3, you'll kind of see that. So.
Interesting. Yeah, no, I didn't realize that. And so I just, it's more of a insurance kind of question, I guess, because again, being in Canada, things are a lot different up here. Different. I think different is the way. Obviously we have like the universal health care, which is awesome, but you know, autism treatment doesn't fall under that.
Right?
So, universal healthcare is misleading. I mean, it's awesome. I mean, you know, I can go to the doctor and not have to worry about a bill later. Absolutely. That's amazing. But there are, you know, there's been I mean, there's for years and years and years, as far back as I can remember, I think back into the 80s even, there's been sort of this push for, you know, autism service to be medically necessary is the phrase they're trying to sort of apply, because if they can apply that, then, you know, maybe they can fall under this universal health care. But right now it doesn't. And so there is funding. It varies from province to province greatly, actually, and it's not very consistent. I mean, I think there is a push for a national sort of strategy, but right now there isn't. But where I live in British Columbia, kids that are under six get, I believe it's $22,000 a year when they have an autism diagnosis, that they can apply to certain services they have sort of this list of services that you're allowed to use your funding for. And then once they turn six, that drops down to $6,000 a year, which they can use for more things, but obviously less options. They only have $6,000. And the rationale is that they're in the school system. And so they sort of say, they claim that the funding is still there, but now those dollars go to the school instead of to the family. But it doesn't really, but it may go into the school education system. But does it actually go to that kid and services specified for that child? Not really. It's sort of like, you know, a school gets funding, special education funding, and then they can sort of, you know, use it for whatever, how many EAs, education assistance they want, and so on and so forth. But, you know, as far as that one kid, yeah, he might get some dedicated staffing or whatever, but, you know, beyond that, it, you know, there's no guarantee of sort of continuation of kind of the BCBA support and all that kind of thing. And yeah, so it's weird. And so this all leads me to ask the question of, because if you were doing assessments in Canada and you're assessing kids five and over, you know, obviously anything helps. And, but you know, these families really need the assessments to happen before six so they can get the real funding happening for that early intervention. After six, it becomes, you know, not as helpful. I mean, it's helpful. There's definitely other services they could access that are free, government provided services, or different things out there. So the question, I guess, is in your neck of the woods, does it work different there? So as far as sort of age goes and money?
Well, yes, but kind of, I don't know, kind of in a different way, it works differently. So yeah. I would say that in terms of the school system, it's very interesting and confusing for a lot of people. So, for example, an autism diagnosis provided by a licensed clinical psychologist that also meets some additional requirements I won't go into now in the state of New Mexico can provide what's called a medically necessary diagnosis. And that's needed for anything outside of school supports. So if you want like community services in any capacity or medical services related to an autism diagnosis, then you need a clinical psychologist to do it. However, schools can provide classifications here for autism. And so you have to have both if you want both settings of services. Mm. So if school says, no, they don't have autism, which would be surprising and would probably be fought pretty hard against if the clinical psychologist said that they did.
Right.
But sometimes what happens is kids will get an early school classification and then not realize that in order to get services once they graduate, they need a medical diagnosis. And so that's when I'll see some of the older kids is their parents are like, now we have nothing because nobody we're not in here. So that being said, so that funding differs as well, though, in that community supports are also much less accessible for older people, I would say. So there's a lot more ABA agencies that work with children than there are with teenagers and adults, for example.
Sure, sure.
So even though they would qualify, there's not a lot of people that do that, at least in my state. Where I was trained, there's a very high saturation of ABA providers that do all sorts of amazing things and specialties and things. Here in my current state in New Mexico, there really are, there's a scarcity of people that can do that. However, how we do funding, though, to kind of add to that and the complications of things is recommendations for the severity, which works within our model and the capitalist model, I would say. So anywhere, you can recommend up to 40 hours a week of ABA. Sometimes people recommend more than all these other services. For a child or an adult, you can recommend it for anybody. However, some people don't need that. Some people need like 10 hours of ABA and then 10 hours of OT and 10 hours of these other things. But ABA agencies can bill insurance for up to 40 hours a week. And so they'll usually try that, especially below the age of 22. After 22, it becomes a lot more complicated. That answers your
question. Yeah, no, well, yes. It's as confusing as it is here. but I think the main point of the question was, and obviously there is some value in still getting a diagnosis at age five. It's just you know, but it varies. And I think it's, you know, in the States, it's I didn't want to get into it, but just because it gets so confusing, just the whole concept of states is very confusing. and how those work and how, you know, how much sort of independence they have and how, you know, how it just differs from, you know, place to place for so many different things, you know, and you just constantly sort of hear about sort of folks, you know, traveling from state to state for different services or for, or for safety. You know, I'm thinking a lot about sort of like gender affirming care and things like that. A lot of the laws that have been coming into play lately, and, you know, folks kind of have to keep, but folks can just, you know, go to another place and do something, but, you know, and so it just, yeah, it can be a rabbit hole of bureaucracy and red tape and yeah. So I don't envy you for having to work in these systems.
For navigating that, yeah, understandable. It is pretty wild. And one thing to add to that that you just kind of made me think of is that it also varies by your insurance. So if you have non-commercial insurance here, which is, you know, like state or federally funded insurance, then you are required to get a reeval. So if you are, let's say you got a reeval at 2, or your initial eval, you got it at 2. Like, yes, this kid has autism. They need services. At 4, if you want to keep having services, you need another one.
Wow.
And yeah, so they continue to have you reevaluate it throughout. So that's another reason to kind of have it throughout the age range, is that you could lose services just in that. Like, if there's nobody who can give you your eval, especially the expected time frame, which has happened in New Mexico, then you lose all of your services, which is sad.
Wow. And is that a database decision? Like, do kids typically get a diagnosis at 2, get a bunch of therapy, and then no longer, you know, get a diagnosis at 4 because they're, you know, as some of the old school ABAers used to say, they're indistinguishable from their peers or whatever?
I would say that it's probably partially data driven, in that sense that, you know, one of the reasons ABA is funded for this is that there is evidence to support that it works. And I do think that it's important. Like, I agree with the perspective that we need to reevaluate what their needs are regularly, which ABA therapists generally do. Like, they're generally looking at their progress and what they need and how many hours we should be dedicating towards this, especially because children might need to spend more time with their families or maybe more able to play sports or whatever, you know, so they want to go and do that, which I think is appropriate. But in terms of the autism diagnosis, there's very few children even with intensive APA, right, that are going to reach that indistinguishable, no longer need any services diagnosis, especially ones that are diagnosed that early, because they will be showing significant delays. Like, they'll be very behind versus kids that don't start showing them until school age.
Right.
So I would say partially the other thing is probably, again, just our state and funding system of like, well, we need to make sure that the money is going to where it should be, or whatever else. We could have an entire other podcast talking to the U.S. about all their systems.
I've got another kind of rabbit hole question you made me think of. You know, and maybe this could just be a rhetorical question, but, you know, sort of the idea that, you know, you could do another evaluation and determine that maybe they don't need any of these services again. I mean, that makes sense. I believe that. But does that evaluation, would that evaluation actually formally remove the actual diagnosis from them?
Yeah, that's a good question. So that's one of the things that is, I think, a little scary about it. Because there are children that I've seen that, even if I don't agree with the diagnosis or lack of diagnosis, that clearly need a lot of support. Like, okay, you know, you evaluated them. Maybe you don't think they have autism, but they clearly are they're struggling. They're very behind, you know, they're engaging in really problematic behaviors, you know, just things that you can see that are really, they really need help and the family needs help. And if you do the reevaluation and say they don't meet criteria for autism, and they no longer get access to services, like those are immediately removed. That being said, you know, the parents can still, you know, if they have the report for their child, they can, you know, show it to school, the original one, or show it to other medical providers. Hey, they were diagnosed with this, because so other people are aware of it. It's still there. But in terms of anything actually helpful and functional immediately, no, they would no longer be considered to have that diagnosis that would then get you services.
It also makes you think about, you know, just sort of, you know, barriers to assessment and whatnot. And, you know, in my neck of the woods, I mean, like, we're lucky that folks only need to get a diagnosis once, and that's it, and they're good. But even then, you know, there's many, many children that, you know, born age two or three, start showing signs that, because the wait lists are so long, don't actually get a diagnosis until they're six or seven, and, you know, and sort of, you know, lose out on that funding. And, you know, the reason primarily, I think, is, you know, not enough folks to do those assessments. But like in your world, you know, this sort of requirement to get reassessed over and over again must really contribute a lot to other folks not being able to get assessed the first time.
Yes. Yeah. I would definitely agree with that, which is really unfortunate. Like, the university that I did my internship year at is probably the main, at least for the past few decades. Now there's been some people trying to address it in different ways and other people trying to get into this field, but they were the main source of evaluations in the state, and they're fantastic. They do multidisciplinary evaluations, gold standard evals. They're training people. They're great. However, their wait lists were getting so long that people would get bumped to other wait lists. Like, you would start the wait list at age two, and then you would be on it for 3 years, and then you have to be on the wait list for the age five, which was, it was really, really tough. And really sad, I think, for people that are just kind of, you know, their child's getting worse perhaps, or just at least falling further behind. They don't have any other way to get services beyond that. So that definitely happens. And so what they've tried to do, and what I've done as well, so the other issue, like I mentioned about differentials, is so those wait lists are also very long here. So like a butyl alcohol syndrome, for example, So if they're like, well, I can't get this tested and I don't know her mom for whatever reason, she's out of the picture, we don't know what happened, mm-hmm. we don't know what to do, we can provide what's called a provisional diagnosis, which is saying like it's consistent with autism, and then that will give you services for a year. But then they have to get evaluated again. Right. And then decide, you know, if they're going to keep it. Fortunately, the re-evals are usually much shorter though, because you already have the main developmental testing.
Right. So a lot of those questions were already answered. Yeah.
And you have the history, and then you can kind of see other responding services as well. So you have somebody else, ideally like a BCBA or an RBT or whoever, working with them and assessing their progress and seeing where they're at. So that is helpful. But yeah, that's definitely something that happens here, is people just getting pushed from wait list to wait list without.
Does an FASD diagnosis get any services?
They do, but it's not typically as well. I would say it's not typically as robust as like an autism diagnosis. So, because they are viewed as medically necessary here, we can write up something called an integrated service plan, which involves community referrals, OT, speech, school, medical, like anything you can think of goes in this report. And that is given to a coordinator for people that have non-commercial insurance, and they qualify for all these services, in-home services. That's it. Like, you are qualified. Yes, there may be wait lists. Yes, there's other things going on, but you have access to them. Versus other disorders, that's not the case. Like intellectual delay or global developmental delay, you get some services, but it's not to that extent. Like, they don't exist in that way. Like, ABA is offered less because it's not viewed as effective, quote unquote, for those groups as it is people.
The reason I ask what FASD is that, as I kind of understand it up my way, you know, the services are very minimal if you don't have an autism diagnosis. Like these other syndromes, even Down syndrome or anything like that, there's not much sort of available compared to sort of autism. And what I hear happening is, and this is in particular with Indigenous children, is, you know, autism, because of sort of, you know, racism kind of within the system, the healthcare system, Indigenous kids, there's an automatic bias assumption that it's FASD, because there's an automatic assumption that the Indigenous mothers are all alcoholics and the parents are all alcoholics, you know, and there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of, and certainly there's, you know, there's some, you know, there's some history around there. I mean, you know, intergenerational trauma related sort of, you know, residential schools and, you know, in the 60s scoop and foster care system and, you know, and, you know, did sort of, you know, yeah, certainly led some folks to, you know, develop an alcoholism disease or anything else, you know, to sort of, you know, try to cope with the incredible trauma that, you know, they and their multiple generations of families went through. But to just, you know, sort of scratch that and say, no, they're all, this is FASD. We're not even going to, you know, do the autism diagnosis. And then, you know, and then they don't get any services. And they're just shafted, and they're just left with this sort of stigma of you know, FASD and alcoholism and all that kind of thing. And so I'm it's nice to hear that at least in your neck of the woods, there is some services available should kind of that direction go. Cause you're right. I mean, because you can't really diagnose it. Am I right that you can't really diagnose it unless you know the mother was actually, you know, it's actually disclosed drinking, or someone's disclosed that, or whatever, or are there other ways now?
So I guess it depends on what you mean by, yeah, you, as terms of diagnosing it. I could not diagnose FASD without somebody disclosing that, or any other sort of neonatal exposure.
Right.
I have no way to determine that otherwise. So if they say, no, that didn't happen, then that's it. It's over. I move on.
Yeah.
But in terms of the medical field, there may be, it's harder when you're small. So like, let's say like 1-2 years old, there are some tests that they can run or review of medical records if they get access to them, right? Mm. Like the NICU or what was going on to see if you were born with any sort of neonatal exposure. Mm. But if you are older, which I've seen a few kids that sadly, you know, just haven't been able to access any sort of service because of their rural location or other barriers. And there's no access to mom saying that, but dad saying it or whatever. You could, there's some other genetic testing that maybe could show that, but it's much less conclusive than if you could just have, if anything else, a medical record of like the child. You could see that there's neonatal exposure when they're born that would impact their development. But if you don't have that, then yeah, I would agree with you. It'd be racist or some other sort of irrelevant and potentially harmful bias on the side of the assessor evaluator to say that when they don't have it. So you should come up with something else.
For sure. And have you done evaluations with like Indigenous kids at all?
Yes. Mm. Yes. I have. And it has not, which maybe is the other side of things, like a blind spot in a way because I'm a part of the group, but it has not crossed my mind that it would be that, like that they would have some sort of drug use contributing to the problem that wasn't disclosed. But I've done a few evaluations with families that are Native American, and then also I've done some treatment in terms of ABA and other sort of approaches with Native Americans, Indigenous groups. Fun.
Yeah. And how has that been received? I've heard a lot of different stories about sort of, and I'm learning more and more. We were talking before we hit record about that I'm going to be interviewing Crystal Hernandez, the host of the Black Feathers podcast. She's also the mother of a autistic boy. And so when we were talking earlier this week, I was curious just about sort of ABA and Indigenous communities and, you know, some of the stories that I've heard about how, you know, it's maybe not so welcome or doesn't sort of integrate well with sort of traditions and cultures and different sorts of things. But she was telling me, you know, it really varies, and it's very individual, like it would be for anybody. But I think there are, again, some louder voices, even in the Indigenous community that sort of, you know, just like there is in sort of the general kind of anti-ABA community that we're hearing right now, that you know, don't necessarily speak for everyone, but make it sound like they do. I'm just curious sort of how, in your experience, you know, working with these folks, well, for number one, has it been kids sort of from sort of a variety of different tribes or whatnot, or are you mostly working with certain folks from a certain group, or have you noticed that?
I'm pausing to think about it. Yeah. I would say what comes to mind immediately with my direct work has been the majority Navajo Nation. I've worked with a few different ones, and some adults have been evaluated with some of the Pueblos around here as well. But I would say majority has been Navajo. And then in terms of, I haven't unfortunately done a lot of like direct work with my tribal members, but instead it's kind of been a part of more systemic things for autism services to Chickasaw members at this point. But would really like to do. I'm trying to extend my license to Oklahoma, so that speaking of states, a state issue. That's a separate concern. But while I'm working on that, doing more systemic things with Chickasaw members to get them more access to services and things like that.
Just sort of, if we sort of think about maybe just the working with the Navajo Nation tribe is, and again, I know that's a very large tribe, and there's lots of different folks and lots of different families and lots of different perspectives. Mm-hmm. But generally speaking, have you, you know, is there a level of sort of autism acceptance, you know, in those communities and sort of, you know, support for the process? Because something that I've heard sort of from some folks is that, you know, a couple of things. One is that sort of diagnosis in general, you know, and the sort of this sort of label of disability and sort of the construct of disability in Indigenous communities is something that's not, you know, not there sort of traditionally, you know, and that, you know, a lot of sort of Western medicine and sort of Western approaches, the DSM and so on and so forth, you know, is very deficit focused and that kind of deficit discourse. And when I talk to every Indigenous guest that I've had on, that is, you know, that's which hasn't been that many, but that's a common thread that, you know, we don't look at things through this deficit lens. And so, you know, we don't even have words, necessary terms even for things like autism and whatnot, because, you know, we see autism. I mean, it's there. But we don't kind of look at it this way. But then when I was talking to Crystal, she was talking about loss of thought. So I've been referencing an interview I did with a guy named Grant Bruno a lot in most episodes. He's a Cree guy from Muscogees, which is kind of in the province east of, in Alberta, and he's got a son, an autistic son, and he's doing his research on his PhD research on sort of autism in First Nations communities. And he talked about how, you know, Sarah, yeah, really cool. He's got a movie. It's called, Being Different? No, it's not. That's not what it is. I'll find it for you. But he's got a little 15-minute short documentary on him and his son. It's super awesome. Includes some small excerpts of ceremony. He just talks about how ceremony is, you know, sort of the most inclusive place there is. But then when I was talking to Crystal, she was like, for sure, but it's also, but it is and it isn't, because, you know, there are some ceremonial sort of situations where, you know, there are no accommodations made for folks with disabilities and those sorts of things, not necessarily out of a lack of want, but just out of a lack of, you know, knowing what to do there. And so those kinds of supports are needed. So again, she really opened my eyes to, again, the nuance of it all and sort of the differences sort of across the way. So I'm just curious, sort of, at least in your experience, what, you know, sort of the perceptions of autism have been in the communities you're working in and sort of, you know, people's thoughts on the diagnosis and so on and so forth.
Yeah, I would say there's more of a range, generally, like just in terms of other factors that contribute to what that means to them. I think there's a delay in getting the diagnosis for several reasons. Like, by that I mean, I think the same concerns may be viewed differently and that some of them trigger a response of, we absolutely must get them in to see a doctor. I'm super mm-hmm. concerned. How do we get them on these way? You know, this kind of immediate process versus mm-hmm. I do think that Indigenous communities are less likely to immediately try to find out through a predominantly white, you know, settler system, what's going on mm-hmm. with their child. I think they will try other routes before that. So they may have other sort of names and terms for it mm-hmm. first, and then kind of be addressing and dealing with that. And then the schools will usually bring it up as, hey, and this is what we need, you know, sort of ways to navigate it. Mm-hmm. So I think that impacts it definitely. I think other things that may impact their response to it would be how you present it. So if you're, for example, saying it's a deficit and they not only don't view things generally in that way, but also they don't view it as important, I think they will also be less interested in getting an evaluation, let alone getting services for that. For example, like a lot of people go in with, oh, it's really important that your child is speaking in full sentences while moving their hands, while looking at you, you know, integrating nonverbal and verbal cues, essentially, right? In the way that we expect them to. And parents sometimes don't care about that. They care that they're not able to participate in ceremony, for example. So kind of how you present it and are aware of like what the family is concerned about first, I think is really important, instead of just assuming that everybody thinks what you think is important.
Yeah.
They'll be less interested in that, especially when you then add, I'm going to send a stranger to your home for 40 hours a week. They're going to be like, I don't want to do that. Why would I do that? What is this person doing? It's very challenging in that way. So I think all those factors kind of contribute to a family or your individual's response to even seeking a diagnosis, let alone getting one, and then services. I think the other thing is that it's, speaking of interaction, is that sort of lack of competence or openness to what ABA can look like in terms of the person explaining it and working with them. Like, I had a very unfortunate incident at a center where a Navajo family wanted to bless the space that their child was going to be in during the COVID pandemic that was going to prevent them from going back to the reservation at the time. And it was just going to involve, I think, some sage use, some burning of sage, but all very safe. And they're willing to do it when there weren't other children there, because that would be one of my concerns, would be like, well, one of the children could run in and not ruin the blessing, essentially. So we would need to time it. But they had no concerns about that. But the person who owned the center denied it. And I thought that was really, I was very upset about that.
It
led to me leaving that center, essentially. The family continued to seek services, which was very upsetting to me as well, in that they didn't have other options. Like, they couldn't do their cultural, or not even just cultural, like something that they wanted to do for their child.
Yeah.
In a space for them. And, but if they wanted their child to be able to speak or participate in family activities, this was what they were told their only option was. So I think if you had that experience, you would be turned off to services. And if you had any other option, you would do those other options, as opposed to, okay, he has autism and now I'm going to, you know, do whatever you say.
Those are such great points. I love the idea of being able to go in and sort of and kind of bless the center. That's wicked.
I was like, parents, this is awesome. Thanks for coming up with that.
Totally. And it just makes it, because I wanted to kind of think about, because it makes you think just what this is all about, around kind of culturally responsive care, culturally responsive assessment. And, you know, I think there's been a lot of conversation about that in some of these larger minority communities, you know, Black and Latina and Latino and so on. And but I haven't, you know, really heard much about sort of culturally responsive care in Indigenous communities. I love the sound of all of that. Also wondering, just from your perspective as an assessor, you know, kind of a two-part question here. Are there things that you do sort of, you know, just kind of adapt the way you do assessments for, you know, maybe Indigenous folks? And kind of related to that, like, do we maybe need something that's more geared towards that? I had a guest on from Nigeria recently, and she's been doing Zifi Nwokolo, and she's been doing her doctoral research was on developing essentially a autism screening tool that was specific to Nigerians.
Wow, that's cool.
Really cool. And she said it validated and so on and so forth. Because just a lot of the things that you observe, I think there was a lot of things that you might observe in a Nigerian sort of, you know, a typical Nigerian family might look like autism, maybe, I think is what she was sort of saying, might look, you know, maybe inappropriate or maladaptive, or whatever term you want to use, but were actually just sort of standard practices and traditions sort of in those communities and needing to kind of deal with that. And, you know, something I've talked about a lot in the podcast is how, generally speaking, a lot of our, you know, assessment and treatment practices in psychology and psychiatry are based on primarily, you know, white subjects and white folks. And I've had a few folks on to talk about, sort of like when I had like Dr. Bays on talking about sort of culturally responsive practices in indigenous communities, and he talked about how, you know, the folks in the indigenous communities have all the same problems that everyone else has, in terms of mental health. It's just, you know, it's just the trust isn't there in the system, you know, just that these professionals are actually there to come and help them, you know. They're there to assess them and, you know, tell them there's a problem and you know, just apply, you know, kind of westernized sort of treatments and whatnot. So I'm just curious what your thoughts are on kind of autism, sort of culture responsive, you know, assessment and treatment. And everyone wants to have control of their life, to make their own choices, decisions, and set goals that are meaningful and important to them. And students who are neurodivergent are no exception. Self-determined research indicates a host of positive quality of life outcomes for people who are neurodivergent, including better employment and independent living outcomes. Whether your students want to attend college or obtain employment after high school, they will need to acquire the skills necessary to pursue career life directions that are personally meaningful and are of their own volition. The self-determination course offered by CBI is an ideal tool for teachers to help students develop the essential competencies for self-determined behavior. The course consists of 5 modules with comprehensive lesson plans that include embedded resources easily adapted for your diverse learners. Using the built-in self-reflection and assessment exercises, teachers can assess students' growth towards their self-determination and self-advocacy behaviors. If you're interested in learning more, check out the CBI Consultants webpage at www.cbiconsultants.com. The second secret word is Navajo. Kind of indigenous communities.
Well, I think it could be better. I'll start with that for a lot of reasons. Mainly the ones that you've already mentioned. But also, I think it would be helpful to reassess what we think of as differences in social communication. Right. So I think the restrictive repetitive behaviors actually do, I don't know what the right word is, they do sort of persist in a similar fashion, I feel like, across a lot of cultures. People are usually able to say, yeah, I don't know a lot of other 4-year-olds that are really interested in paper towels or in, you know, the advancement of neurodynamics or whatever. Right. Like most people are able to like say, yeah, from my perspective, you know, and all the kids they're around, this is, you know, unusual. Or, I see him doing things like repeating himself or moving stuff, you know, that I find unsettling, right? Like, I feel like a bit part of the reason for that might be that that is a broader definition. Like, I don't say, oh, well, your child spins in circles for 10 minutes, but do they move their hands in front of their face? Oh, they don't move their hands in front of their face? Well, forget about the spinning in circles. Right? Mm. Like, it's a pretty broad way that parents can integrate like what they view as like repetitive and restricted and unusual for who they're around.
Sure.
Versus social communication, there's still some, right? I mean, there's some behaviors that kids do over and over and adults do over and over that wouldn't qualify, you know, there's bounds, but
yeah,
it's a lot more flexible versus the social communication that I feel like we look at, even with a lot of measures that I use, are very focused on the cultural norms of educated white people, you know, like, yeah, and people that are in cities have access to resources and that sort of things. I think they're trying to broaden it. They definitely have made some efforts and they are getting more variety of diagnoses, at least in the US, like more representative, which I think is a good sign of something. But I do think it needs to be adjusted as into, well, what do you think is unusual or impairing or difficult when you're interacting with them? You know, if you don't care that their tone of voice doesn't vary a lot, and in fact, that would be upsetting to you, then that's what I need to know, is that you're having a hard time understanding them. They're having a hard time getting their needs met, and developing relationships with important people, not necessarily that they're not looking at you all the time.
Right.
Tone of voice, right?
Yeah.
So I think that would be helpful if we had more objective measures that looked more at it in that way versus I sort of just integrate that, you know, so when I'm interacting with them, I also ask family members, when at all possible, you know, what do you think about this? Like, I noticed that they did this a lot. Is that representative? Did you think they were just nervous? You know, what is it just like for you all when they do this kind of behavior? But again, that integrates into my overall diagnosis. And there is a measure that gets at that a little better, but the gold standard measure doesn't include that in the scoring. The gold standard measure says, did they make eye contact appropriately? Yes or no. And that's it.
And so even if culturally, you know, making eye contact, you know, wasn't the norm, that assessment wouldn't be able to pick up on that. It's just a yes or no, and you're one step closer to autism, even though you've been taught by your family not to look at them.
Yeah. So even if it's, yeah, you're actually being culturally responsive and actually picking up on the social cue of like, oh, wait, this is not appropriate to stare at a stranger or ask an adult the questions, which is another part of this, is you're supposed to, you know, interact in a reciprocal way. But a lot of children are taught to not do that with adults, especially strange adults.
Yes.
So they're actually, you're getting sort of the opposite information. Yeah. But this test, well, of course, you know, it's on the clinician and the people that develop the test, they, you know, you need to use your clinical judgment. You're going to get these scores that then you have to explain because they're saying, yeah, they're not, it's not well modulated. They're not using eye contact to communicate with me, because I view eye contact as a way to communicate that they want my attention or to like look at something or whatever, but they don't use it that way, but they still get that score. And then you're still something that would address that, I think, would be fantastic.
Cause I mean, I think it's a lot simpler sort of, if we kind of move from assessment to sort of treatment, you know, to do a culturally responsive functional assessment or whatever, or even a culturally responsive, you know, sort of curriculum type assessment, because you can just change the questions and change the way your intervention is going to look, you know, so, you know, there's certainly in functional assessment, you're just asking the who, what, where, what, and why questions. And so, you know, that should be fine, but these assessments, you know, they're very rigid to these sorts of particular kind of benchmarks that, you know, may not actually be, you know, related to autism. They're just related to culture.
Right. Yeah. And yeah, you wanted to. I mean, I think ABA gets a really bad wrap in terms of them being like, oh, you want them to be a robot or you're training them or whatever. But if you're doing ABA well, it is naturally culturally responsive, which I think is a huge strength of ABA, because it is looking at what is the function of this, how can we reach the individual and family goals and do that with the individual, right? Like with them directly, not just you know, what we think of as important. Mm-hmm. Like you said, there's so many adaptations that are required. You cannot just go in and be like, well, this works for Johnny, so I'm going to do the exact same intervention. No, you have to do the functional analysis anyway, even if the behavior is the same.
Right? Yep.
So.
And you're not the first, you're actually the third now, Indigenous behavior analyst to tell me, you know, how, you know, with ABAs being such a natural science, it fits really well within Indigenous communities. Louis Bush is a behavior analyst in Canada, who told me, he said elders in at least in his community are probably some of the best behavior analysts in the world. Just naturally, they're just the way they do things. I had talked to Deb Fernando on, when you'll see this episode come out soon enough. She is the only Indigenous behavior analyst in Australia. And Indigenous Australian, obviously that's someone, she's got her tribe is in my show notes. I got to look it up, but she just talked to me again about same thing, about just how it works just so well in these communities that she's working in, because it's such a natural science, and there's no sort of, it doesn't have all these sorts of, you know, sort of standardized kind of bells and whistles that aren't culture responsive, because you can do it in any way you want, and so it fits really nice. But if you're not, you know, this just goes back to the broader conversation on sort of, you know, culturally responsive care and cultural humility and leaving your biases at the door. All right, this is really cool. So now I like to a little under an hour left. I wouldn't mind talking about learning more about the Chickasaw and kind of what it means to be Chickasaw and kind of a bit on that. I'm trying on the podcast to both for my learning, but I think for everyone who's listening, to help folks understand that all these tribes and nations are so different from each other, just like all the nations we already know about, you know, and that Indigenous is really is a colonial term that, you know, we've applied to sort of label these folks that are from the lands that we invaded. And really, you know, every piece of land on the planet has had Indigenous people. Like, my people are probably Indigenous to some area in Germany somewhere. They probably relate back to, you know, some of those peoples, you know, thousands of years ago. Being Indigenous, it doesn't really mean anything in that regard. Like, the term doesn't mean a whole lot, and it tends to generalize folks. And so, you know, I'm no more the same as an Indigenous German as, you know, as an Indigenous, person from Japan, or Indigenous person from, you know, Papua New Guinea. None of us are alike. And what we tend to do in North America is lump Indigenous people all into one category. And there's some of the stuff that we're doing in there. You know, I think, yes, we need to reconcile with all Indigenous people. So yes, that's a good way to use the Indigenous term. But after that, you got to start learning that these communities are all so different from each other. And so I really want to, whenever possible, if I get a guest on that's from, you know, a different tribe, I just want to learn a bit about the tribe and learn a bit about kind of what's going on and learn about how, you know, there's different things happening. And so I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about what it sort of means to be Chickasaw and kind of a little bit of the history, you know, and a little bit of the demographics. I know a lot of this stuff changes and wars and battles and different things over time, but what I do know is it's a very big tribe and whatnot, but that's about all I know.
Okay, sure. I'll do my best. I can tell you that, at least for me, I'm very proud to be a Chickasaw. I don't really know what it means for other people, but for me, it means that I'm really connected to a community that has a lot of strong values and really tries to support tribal members and their loved ones as well benefit from it. But we really like have clear values, I think, as a tribe. It seems to at least be, you know, economic independence. So not relying on people outside of our tribe to support us as much as possible. I know it's very important. Education is always promoted. Family is huge. So like in that community, buddy, really, but you know, being connected around loved ones, spending time with loved ones is really big in our community. Health has always been a priority. So we have our own health system, which is unique. I think a few other tribes have started doing that recently, but I think we may have been the first. Sorry, there's another tribe that wants to shout out later. Yeah. Let me know. But to develop our own outside of the Indian health system, because the federal system has been problematic for a lot of reasons. But also, I would say those are kind of the main values, like education, independence, but also like family connection and tradition, are all pretty big for my tribe. From my perspective, that's what it means. Literally, in a fun way, Chickasaw means rebel. So we were actually originally part of the Cherokee tribe and then broke off, and they named us the Chickasaws for kind of rebelling against what was happening at the time. Yeah, so in that sense, but we're very peaceful with the Cherokee now, you know. We're part of it, we're all but that's they kind of broke up.
And would there be there would being that it used to be Cherokee, is are there must be like family connections between the two too?
I'm sure even currently, because we, even though we broke off, we didn't, Cherokee have a similar history even following that separation, in that they were also part of what originally was called the Trail of Tears. It's called something else now. My parents told me about it recently, and I'm not going to say it because I'm going to guess and it'll be wrong, but they're also part of that. So there's also overlap obviously between that, like even though we separated, we weren't, you know, totally disconnected from them in terms of the continual family history. But yeah, we were part of the 5 tribes, which share several parts of history together, which are the reasons we're lumped together. One of those is that we had a government and a language at the time of invasion, I guess you would call it. I don't know, when white people contact, I guess is the politically correct term at the time of contact, versus many tribes did not. However, I still am confused about this part of history. So if you interview an Iroquois, I would love to know more about this, because I haven't found out why the Iroquois were not a part of the 5 tribes. Because they did have a very sophisticated government system and language at that same time. So that, I don't know what part of history I'm missing with that, but that is my understanding of it, is that these 5 tribes, and the Iroquois were also in a similar region. I'm not great at geography, but it's not that the Iroquois were on the West Coast and we were on the East Coast, and then they just, you know, happened to be that. So not sure about that separation. But the 5 tribes are the Chickasaw, Cherokee, Choctaw, Seminole, and Creek. And so if you were to, if you still had the urge to lump us together, then that would probably be the way that you would do that in terms of our history. If you needed to find someone, other groups that we shared a more similar history to. Beyond just like the contact that you're talking about of indigenous people in general.
Is there among the 5 tribes, is there a common language?
We speak different languages.
And what's the language in Chickasaw?
I think it's Chickasaw. Like Chickasaw, Shock, Limpy, if I'm pronouncing that right, means I'm a proud Chickasaw. They have created an app, so anybody that's interested in learning about it, and they've been through Rosetta Stone. If you want to do old school language learning, that has it all, and videos that are really cool, where they teach you, they have some of the Chickasaw tribal members like talking to each other and doing that, where you can kind of learn the language. that way.
Neat. Yeah. And would it be similar to the Cherokee language, being that you split off, or did a new language form as you split off, or do you even know?
I mean,
we could Google that one.
Yeah, we may have to research that one. I think it is different. However, I'm although I speak Spanish as well, right. I'm not a linguistic kind of person.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure it makes language different. Well, interested though. So if you do find out.
Do you know if there's a lot of speakers? Because I know it's something that's a thing sort of definitely in my neck of the woods is that, you know, there are a lot of in sort of north of the border, tribe is not often the language used. It's usually come off in nations. I think tribe is used sometimes, but anyway, there are a lot of these indigenous communities where language has been lost, or there's very few, or even like one or two speakers, and we're actually seeing it sounds like, from what I've seen, there's a lot of sort of younger folks that are doing a really cool job of kind of revitalizing and bringing back languages and because it essentially, you know, again, going back to sort of the history of racism and the residential schools and whatnot, that whole process was around assimilation and taking away languages and traditions and practices. And so these languages, you know, literally died, you know, with a generation of people that weren't allowed to sort of speak it and learn it. And because, you know, as folks may know, and, you know, in indigenous communities, generally speaking, information is passed through oral traditions, not written. And so, you know, if there's no one to pass it on, there's no learning happening. So is there a lot of speakers in Chickasaw that you know of, or do you, I mean, they know?
So I'd have to say, sadly, no. Actually, the creation of the app, there was a response to that. So there was a recognition that the at least like first speakers, so people whose first language was Chickasaw, as opposed to English, was really reducing. I think there was at the time they created the app, they were saying there's definitely less than 100. There may have been less than 10 at the time that they're like, we need to do this. You know, we need to dedicate time and resources to preserving the language, was because of that significant decrease. I'm not sure where it's at now. I'm hoping that the app was successful and there are other people that are becoming more fluent than I am in it in the current time.
Yeah. And so the other thing you said kind of early on is that there's not a reservation. What's that about?
So we were moved, like a lot of other tribes, into the Oklahoma region. Other tribes were kind of disseminated, Alabama, Florida, that sort of area as well. But we were allocated land there. But then we sold it. And so those who are familiar with the University of Oklahoma, Boomer Sooner is like their chant there. And it's actually a reference to that. So when the Chickasaws sold their land, they had a land rush. And so the people that cheated are called the Sooners, that rushed to the land to claim it as we sort of sold. So. It's kind of integrated into that history there as well. But yeah, so we don't have a reservation because it was worth something that people bought, I guess.
And so, but there's a whole Chickasaw Nation and all these systems in place and whatnot. Do folks just sort of live, you know, I mean, folks probably own land. I mean, they're just humans in the States. They probably own land, but it's not specifically Chickasaw land. It's just Bob's land.
So we do have our own land. So we do have tribal lands. For example, the capital of Chickasaw Nation is Tishomingo, Oklahoma. So we do have that as a separate sort of nation, but also within. Also, interestingly, not to go off on an entire side note, but it was kind of creating a big shake here in the U.S. is that they did rule in Oklahoma that you cannot be prosecuted by white, or I guess U.S. I shouldn't just say white, U.S. prosecutors if you are Native American. So somebody, they ruled that because somebody's being prosecuted for a murder that occurred within tribal lands, and so they cannot be prosecuted at all. So it definitely exists in very, very clear terms, legally, federally recognized, all of those things. But it's not a reservation because we were not forced to stay there in the same way. So, for example, the Navajo Nation reservation has always been there. I mean, always is a strong term, but they were not moved there. They're not relocated there. They were there and have stayed there. Versus us kind of being moved between lands and then establishing our own lands that we own versus being given those lands via the federal government is my understanding of it. So they exist, but they're not a reservation.
Really cool. One more thing. So they're kind of one of the way I kind of found you initially in Google Land was through this the scholarship that the Chickasaw folks kind of helped you with. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
So that was the Chickasaw Lifetime Scholarship. I was incredibly fortunate to receive it. There were several before me that they actually did a little series on that I think is still on their website where they have allocated it. It's one person at a time. I think it was up to 5 recipients could have it at any time. So it was funding for your education, and that could continue as long as you were in school, and they would pay up to $30,000 a year for tuition, books, like school related things. Yeah, it was incredibly generous. I got it my junior year of college. So I applied 3 times and got like closer each time to try to get it. And so they, anyway, when I got it my junior year in college, and it continued until I graduated from Rutgers. So that was, I think, 6 years, 7 years of funding.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, it was really amazing. It was super helpful in so many ways. And now they continue to do it. As far as I know, they're not doing it anymore, which is a bummer, but they have a lot of other really great scholarships for education throughout the state, and also like wherever Chickasaw members are. So,
yeah. Really cool. And and something I read in I think a couple of the different, you know, sort of stories that they were writing about you know, you getting the scholarship and your experience was that, you know, eventually there's the Rutgers story here. Jaxie Odom plans to bring expertise on autism back to her tribe where the disorder is still in the shadows. Now, granted that's a headline they wrote, so I don't know how accurate. But is that the case? Not the first part, because you're telling me that you are trying to extend your license to Oklahoma so that you can actually, you know, do some more down there. So I know you're working on that piece. But is the disorder in the shadows in the Chickasaw Nation?
Well, so I guess first I would respond to yes, I am trying to do more. And originally there was a service component to the scholarship. So what would happen is I would go back and work directly with my tribe for 2 years following graduation. Very unfortunately as well, COVID happened right at that time. So we were getting creative on how I could do that. So that's been a little different as well with that part. But I would say there's been a lot of progress since even just the past 5 years. I think the article was probably written 6 years.
This is 2017, so it's been a while.
So Shannon Dial, I want to give her a shout out, but there's been for other people as well. I've done a lot of work to bring it more to the forefront, not only within our tribe, but within Oklahoma as well. There are a lot of barriers there, like to get services, to get diagnoses. For a while, it wasn't covered by insurance at all. So like she was a major player in getting insurance to cover autism diagnosis and treatment. Regardless of tribal status, if you can't have that, that's going to be a major barrier because it's incredibly expensive. But I would say there is a lot more awareness because she is working directly with the tribe to bring that awareness, but also those services and do research directly with them and what they need within those community bounds as well. So she, you know, Chickasaw Nation as a whole, of course, can be anywhere. Like I'm in New Mexico, but within, you know, rural Southeast Oklahoma where our tribal lands are, getting that sort of awareness out there has been successful, I think, mainly because of people like her and the tribe's openness to supporting it as well. Like they knew that that was what I wanted to do and they agreed to support me in doing that.
Right. They saw the value in having this service come back to them.
Yes. Yeah. Cause that's part of the application. It's like, well, what are you going to, you know, what are you going to do with this? What are our needs? And so they did that. And you have to do it. So if you fail or if you change your, so like, let's say I didn't pass a needed class or a year or something, or if I said, no, I want to be a dentist, then they can remove the scholarship. Like it's very important to them, like what you plan to do with it.
I see.
So
yeah.
It's
that's awesome. So you're in New Mexico and you've been there for a while.
The third secret word is rebel.
And you say there's sort of Chickasaw folk kind of everywhere. Do you have opportunities sort of then in New Mexico to sort of, you know, take part in sort of customs and ceremony and whatnot?
Yeah, I would say it's less so than in Oklahoma, but they have regular meetings. So you might call them a powwow, but I don't know if that's the right word, but where they send it out, it's actually kind of formal. They send like the old school letters and stuff to you and they say you're invited. So like every few months, we all get together. And that kind of varies what that meeting looks like. I would say in terms of like feast days, ceremonies, other things like that, there's a lot more opportunities to participate in other tribes than Chickasaws here specifically. Like I said, it exists. There's meetings, there's gatherings, and that's nice, but most of them are in Oklahoma and we have gatherings of nations here in New Mexico. So that's a really cool opportunity that doesn't have to do with my tribe specifically, but is really amazing. So
what is that? Tell me about that.
Oh, if you get the opportunity, come. It is amazing. It's amazing. So the Gathering of Nations is the largest, I guess, celebration might be a way to look at it, in, as far as I know, the world of Indigenous First Nation communities. They have, I think it's almost a week. It's at least a few days. I think it might be a week where they have all, so they have competitions, they have dances, they have food. It takes place at this huge convention center. It's just like all the celebration, and they share histories and storytelling over several days, just focused on all the nations that are there. So not just that are here regularly, but people come from all over to kind of represent. There's music. I think a tribe called Red, if you've heard of them.
Yeah.
I think they're Canadian.
Cool. Yeah, they're huge here. Yeah, that's awesome. Right on. Neat. So, what's any kind of current or kind of future goals, plans for you?
Well, I mean, relatedly, I really do want to do more work with my tribe, with the Chickasaws, to figure out what the needs are and how I can help with that. Most effectively, it seems like they need people that do ABA, they need people, you know, to do diagnostic assessments, but figuring out how I can do that best would be great. That's a big goal for me. Either from here or traveling there every now and then, or whatever they need, virtual.
Yeah.
Whatever would work. I'm still working on that. That's a big goal for me for sure. But I think otherwise, doing some stuff here too. I am working with a few agencies to develop relationships with some of the native communities here as well, to like reach out and figure out what we can do to, again, help meet their needs and go to them instead of asking them to come to us. Those goals are really important. And then even beyond the native community, you know, reaching other marginalized communities as well. So my entire internship year was Spanish speakers. I think I maybe had a few, well, I had some Native Americans that spoke their native language and then English and Spanish, or some Native Americans that didn't speak English. But every week I would say, you know, I saw at least the majority of my training was in Spanish, I would say, for that year. But since then, I haven't really seen a lot of Spanish speaking kids. And so I feel like that's a big need that's not being met. For some reason, they're only going through UNM, and I'm kind of, they're just creating a big delay. You know, they're not kidding, because they're on the wait list and all those other things. So, and it needs to be done in their native language. You know, it's like we're saying, social communication. If you can't do it in that way, how are you going to get an apt view of that? So I want to do more work in that community as well. Otherwise, you know, I was working on my BCBA CEUs, so keeping my license and my certification going, constant goals, I would say. But
have you thought at all about ways or around sort of, you know, not building capacity, but around kind of having more Indigenous BCBA practitioners and RBTs and whatnot, because I think that's something that could be cool and seems to be missing. And I know, and that was kind of another reason why I wanted to have you on, was I think it's just be great for, you know, some of these younger kids to see that, someone who's Indigenous can get a BCBAD, and it's possible. And, think you could be a real model for a lot of these folks.
Oh, well, that's nice. I mean, I would be really open to doing that. I think one of the reasons I haven't thought about it as specifically, although I'm actually a part of a presentation that I'm putting together with one of the agencies I previously mentioned, that's recruiting some RBTs. But I guess I thought about it as like, we just need more of them in general, and addressing the barriers as to why people are not pursuing that career. But yeah, definitely, if we get more natives in there, then that would be a huge bonus. I would love to support any sort of career trajectory there. RBT, BCBAD, BCBA, psychologist, I mean, all the acronyms, whatever they want to do.
They're all lacking. I mean, something Crystal was saying, which that she said she's, you know, I don't know if she's doing, but would like to, you know, be involved in is, which I think would be super cool, is, you know, trying to get more specific programs in tribal colleges and universities and that sort of thing.
I think that would be huge. That's a great idea. And somewhere like UNM would be great. We do have a lot of, like one of the reasons I think I saw more Native Americans, especially Navajo, while I was doing training there, was that we had someone on staff who spoke Navajo and was like a member of that nation and did a lot of trainings and how, you know, like they're very integrated within the system that could do that. And so I think UNM would be a good part for this too. But yeah, University of Oklahoma, like anywhere that has Native American studies or where they're, our Native American college in and of itself, like presenting it as an option there, right? Like you can study for this. This is what this is. I mean, I think a lot of colleges don't even know what, you know, present it unless they have some path for it. But that would be great. I know college, are you familiar with College Horizons?
No.
So they're not a college, they're a college prep for Native Americans. And I participated in it. Really, really amazing. So if there are other Native youth out there that would like some support for like how to navigate college, even applying to college, it was really amazing. It's like a it's like a camp, and you just go and you're with a bunch of other Native kids that are trying to go to college, and it's really fun. And they have people that are there to kind of help you navigate that. So maybe letting them know. I hadn't thought about that until now. Maybe just reach out to them. It's like, hey, you should throw out that they could do this. So yeah, that would be fantastic. We should go to them. I guess stop asking people to come to us. We should go to them. It's a great strategy.
Yeah, because so far, I don't think I told you, I've met one Indigenous RBT so far. And I had her on the podcast. She's Seminole, and she's Seminole actually. From the Seminole Nation, and but based in Hawaii. So super cool. Jaxie, so awesome. You're doing so many cool things. This was great. I learned so much from you. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast. This was neat.
Of course. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Awesome. Cool.
Small correction, Jordan Burleson is not from the Seminole tribe. She is from the Tonawanda Seneca tribe, and you can learn all about her in episode 130. Cheers.